From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a Michigan congressman explains his yes vote for the farm bill.
I agree with those critics of the SNAP cuts. They're more than I think what we should have had to include in this bill.
What's Governor Snyder really saying with his new budget?
I think he's kind of, in a sense, thumbing his nose at both sides.
How Michigan yarn will keep America's Olympic athletes warm in Sochi.
Someone called and asked for samples and a color card, and when they were giving me the address to send it to, it was Polo Ralph Lauren, New York City, in which my jaw just kind of dropped open.
And LBJ's War on Poverty 50 years later.
Poverty's become one of those words of the past. People don't want to talk about poverty as much, in large part because of a lot of the political backlash.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and thank you so much for joining us on this Thursday. After years of debate, Congress finally sent the nearly $1 trillion farm bill to President Obama. On today's show, Congressman Dan Kildee of Flint will join us to talk about why he voted in favor of the measure, even as some of his Democratic colleagues voted no. And then later in the hour, Michigan Radio's political commentator Jack Lessenberry is here. He'll explain why fixing Michigan's voting system may be harder than you think. But first, it's Thursday, and that means it's time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. He's been going through Governor Snyder's proposed budget for the new fiscal year, and he's decided the governor has something going for him, something that President George Herbert Walker Bush once called the Big Mo. So, Daniel, why is the Big Mo going for Snyder?
Well, I think he's just trying to take advantage of the situation that he has with what's going on in the state economy, action and movement in Detroit. He's got his budgetary restructuring of the previous years has created a surplus that he can now, in an election year, kind of sprinkle around in some strategic areas, and he's doing that in education, higher education, a targeted tax cut. He's kind of standing up to the GOP caucus in the legislature and saying, I don't think a across-the-board income tax cut's the way to go, but maybe there are some other things that he can do. And, you know, this is an election year, and we have to recognize it for what it is. I mean, this governor always likes to talk about how he's apolitical, and in some ways I think he may be, but I don't know that the people around him are.
Right, right. Well, you actually make an interesting point in your column in the news today that you think this new Snyder budget isn't powered by the left or the right, but is kind of taking a third path?
Well, I think he's kind of, in a sense, thumbing his nose at both sides. You know, you're hearing Democrats already say, well, it's just a restoration of what was. It's not additional funding. You know, complain, complain, complain. You know, we always need more, more, more. And on the other hand, you have his Republicans in the legislature saying, you know, we just need a tax cut. Everything's got to be a tax cut. Meanwhile, the roads are falling apart. The bridges are a problem. We got all sorts of infrastructure issues here, and we clearly are lagging behind in our higher education spend. What I like about what he's doing is he's saying, okay, I'm going to give more to higher education, but I'm going to condition it on certain levels of performance from state institutions, and that's probably a good thing, too. But I think if you look at his agenda, it very much dovetails with things you're seeing come out of groups like the Business Leaders from Michigan, which is basically saying, look, as opposed to being Republican or Democrat, what we need to do is look at what other states are doing and what makes those states competitive and competing for jobs and investment. There's two things that I think are very critical there. One is higher education and being able to create people and produce people that can actually work in our economy. You know, this economy has 50, 60, 70,000 jobs on a rolling basis that are going unfilled because we're not producing the kind of people that can do those jobs.
Right.
And we're also not attracting people from outside the state who can do those jobs. So I think the argument the business people make is we have to do things that make us more attractive. And sometimes the things that they're pushing are offensive to either Republicans or to Democrats because they don't hew to the traditional political lines that both of them tend to push.
And this governor who says he's apolitical, although some may argue that right to work proved that perhaps not so much. But nonetheless, when you look at what he's doing, as you say, it supports the view of the traditional building blocks of Michigan's economy with get a high school diploma and get yourself an assembly job for life. These are well and truly buried.
Well, they ought to be. I mean, you know, we live in a different era. And what I see on our message boards at the DetroitNews.com is a lot of people, you know, as the phrase goes, fighting the last war. We live in a different time. I mean, the car companies, for example, are dramatically different than anything anybody has remembered. Not only are they very profitable, very much technology-driven. One of the greatest consumers and utilizers of high technology of any industry in the world. This is a technologically driven economy. I don't think there's any question about it. And the kind of people that are prospering and getting jobs in this economy are prepared for those kinds of jobs. They don't just come out of school and say, hey, just hire me. They've got to be employable. We see the same thing in the city of Detroit. People will talk about, you know, there are no jobs. Well, even if there are jobs and you have a city where half of the population is illiterate, are they employable in 2014? I think a lot of people would say in a lot of businesses the answer is no.
I'm speaking with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Houses. We kind of take a look at Governor Snyder's new budget and realizing the economy is giving the governor a re-election bump, as Daniel put it in his column. And you do agree Rick Snyder's first term and his re-election bid are very much helped by a recovery that was already happening when he took office. So he's reaping the rewards of auto bailouts and corporate restructuring?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we have to be honest here. Just as Jennifer Granholm got pummeled by the global financial meltdown and the recession, and I think she clearly did, she didn't cause those conditions. By the time Rick Snyder was elected and came to office, the economy was starting to gear up. The auto bailouts had already been done by the feds, essentially, and these companies were moving forward. So that went from being an active issue to being a historical debate, and that was already moving. Now, I don't want to overdraw this. I mean, there are certain things that were happening that have helped him. I don't think there's any question. But some of the financial restructuring that he was able to do at the state and his team was able to do is something that I would argue that the people that were there before them were not capable of doing. I mean, they're doing multi-year budgeting. They've gotten very aggressive in terms of trying to pay down certain liabilities. We see that in this proposed budget where he's proposing to put more into the teacher retirement fund so that the unfunded liabilities down the road are not as large. So whoever succeeds him in this office, whether it's in another year or in 5 years, is going to be in a better position because these guys are trying to pay down and be more financially, I think, responsible, as opposed to spending all the surplus or turning around and giving the whole surplus back to people in the form of an across-the-board income tax cut.
Which would be little dribs and drabs.
Right. Yeah. And in a lot of senses, that's not a lot of money to a lot of people. But there are some very real issues and some real priorities, I think, that the state has to look at. What do we need to be doing? We don't need to be doing everything, but what do we need to be doing?
Well, let me just kind of pursue this a little. So, yes, we agree that the auto bailouts and the corporate restructuring has helped him. So I'm wondering your thoughts. Did the tax shift that he gave, that gave a break to small businesses and raised taxes on pensioners, did it really produce the jobs the governor promised? I mean, if you minused out the auto recovery jobs and the manufacturing rebound that goes with that recovery, what do things really look like?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think the short answer to that is probably not as much as a lot of people thought. But I do think that you have to recognize that our businesses are changing in a lot of ways. Productivity is enabling a lot of businesses to do as much, if not more, with fewer people. And that's, again, another reality that we live in. I think the other thing that was important there is, the larger businesses, like the auto companies, ended up paying more under this tax shift. Smaller businesses did get a break, and it's fair to ask the question that you're raising. But I would also come back to the other point is, and I've raised this many times with people, if the guy living next door to you has a public pension and you have a 401k, when you retire, you have to pay taxes on that money when you pull out the 401k, and he doesn't. Why is he special? And every time I've had this conversation with people who complain about this fact, they don't answer the question because they're not special. They're no more special than you and I. You know, and I think that's part of the argument that he's making is if you have a retirement fund and some people have to pay taxes on it, why should people who are drawing a public pension not also have to pay a Michigan income tax on it? And I think most people would say that's a fair question. I mean, the fact that they don't answer the question to me, I think it says a lot. You know, they change the subject. And I think when he makes that argument about that this is a question of fundamental fairness, I think that resonates with some people. It may not resonate with a guy that's getting his pension tax.
Sure.
But it resonates with people who are getting their 401ks taxed when they start pulling money out.
Yeah.
And I think that's another point. I mean, you can ask that question, by the way, of where are the jobs in the context of a lot of things they've done. The business tax reform is a good example. Another one is right to work. Where are the jobs? I happen to think that this is a cumulative process, that over time you become more competitive, and it's a whole matrix of things that are happening. It is right to work. It's the tax burden. It's how vibrant is your business community. What's happening in the city of Detroit? Where are they in the restructuring and the bankruptcy? I think all that stuff tends to have a cumulative effect. So to sit there and say, well, we've got right to work, we don't have all these jobs, where are the jobs? It didn't work. It's obviously a failure.
Give it time.
You got to give it time. And if you look at states down south that have reaped this benefit, it's been something that's been a multi-year and even a multi-decade process.
Finally, just a quick thought, if I could ask you, what did you not see in the budget, Daniel, you wish had been there?
Well, I think they need to get serious about roads, the issue of roads in Michigan. And we are in a very unique geographical situation, being surrounded by water like we are, and that those huge bodies of water have major effects on weather and freeze and thaw and all sorts of other things, which is one of the reasons we have a lot of the problems that we have. But I do think that the legislature needs to be realistic about what it is that needs to be done, and what kind of burdens they're putting on future legislatures and future governors by basically saying we're not going to do this and we're not going to raise any taxes to devote to reconstructing the roads. And again, I think the governor makes an argument that can resonate with both Republicans and Democrats, i.e., you know, it's going to cost a lot less if we do this now than it is if we essentially delay replacing the roof and then it starts leaking and we have to rebuild the whole inside of the house.
Well put. Daniel Howes, Detroit News business columnist, with our Thursday check-in. As always, thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. During his recent State of the Union speech, President Obama made passing mention of our voting system.
Citizenship means standing up for everyone's right to vote. Last year, part of the Voting Rights Act was weakened, but conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats are working together to strengthen it. And the bipartisan commission I appointed, chaired by my campaign lawyer and Governor Romney's campaign lawyer, came together and have offered reforms so that no one has to wait more than a half hour to vote. Let's support these efforts. It should be the power of our vote, not the size of our bank accounts, that drives our democracy.
So the voting system is on the president's mind, and it is on the mind of Michigan Radio's political commentator, Jack Lessenberry. Hello, Jack.
Good to be here.
That newly released report from the Presidential Commission on Election Administration really got you thinking about the problems that you see with our voting system, yes?
Well, Michigan has problems sort of apart from that, and Michigan has sort of lagged a lot of other states in not having any early voting and not having any no questions asked absentee voting.
So the idea that that is costing us time and money and people who don't get to the polls.
Well, it's preventing some people clearly from voting who don't have the time or the patience for the aggravation. Now, if you're over 60 years of age, or if you are out of state, you can get an absentee ballot, or I think in most places you can pretend that you're going to be out of state, but otherwise you're not. And there's no such thing as early voting. In Ohio, for example, there's certain designated places and times when you can show up and go to the polls and use the voting machine. It's not always all of the precincts, but you can go to some place and vote on a different day. And nationwide, more and more people are doing that. But Michigan is not the case. And nationally, I think in Ohio, for example, only about 30% of the voters actually show up at the polling places on Election Day. The rest either do absentee or early voting. In Michigan, 77% in the last election voted on Election Day. The rest had absentee ballots. So it's in this modern era, we're certainly lagging.
Why is it that we're lagging? Why the foot dragging?
Well, the foot dragging is mainly on the part of the Republican Party. Republicans benefit, as a rule, from lower turnouts. The higher the turnout, generally, the better Democrats do. That's not always been the case, but in most elections it is the case. And people who are more problematical about voting tend to vote more Democratic, and Republicans in the legislature have blocked any attempt to change this. Now, the Secretary of State, Ruth Johnson, who herself is a Republican, has come out in favor of no reason absentee voting. She hasn't really come out for early voting, but that would mean that for whatever reason, you could have an absentee ballot. But again, the legislature opposes that.
Now, I have to ask, Election Day is Election Day. Should we dilute that for the convenience of people who can't be bothered turning up on the second Tuesday in November?
Well, you could make that argument if we were a sedentary agricultural society and none of us ever went more than 10 miles from where we lived. But not only has our society changed a lot, there are a lot of people who have jobs that require them to travel all the time. But the ballot has changed. If you are going to the polls and voting only for president, only for governor, or for three or four offices, that's one thing. But my contention is that it's totally irresponsible for anybody to go and vote on Election Day at the polling place. Why? Because there are so many races, and there are often these complex ballot propositions. Mm-hmm. So unless you get a sample ballot in advance, study it, and make a list, you can't be a responsible voter. I do this stuff for a living. I've been involved in reporting and studying politics for more than 40 years, but I can't tell. I mean, there are races for trustees for community college, say, that I have to study, and I have to call people who know more than I do. I don't know how the average person can make informed decisions.
And how about online registration? How is that working in the states allowing it?
Well, you know, it's curious. I have tended to be very skeptical of that because of the potential for fraud, but mm-hmm. there was this commission that you mentioned that did a study, and they found that in the 18 or 19 states that allow online registration, they actually have more safeguards than registration by mail. One of the more hilarious things that happened recently is the Secretary of State in Michigan was complaining that that people who were actually not even American citizens were registering and voting, and it turned out not only were there very few of those, but that she had signed them up because these people had gone for a driver's license, and they asked at the Secretary of State's office, do you want to register to vote? And they didn't know enough not to do so. But apparently there are enough safeguards now that, you know, I really think there are very few criminals that say, I'm going to hack into the system so I can vote. They're more likely to steal credit cards from people at Target. But
there
I don't
you go.
Know any, we don't have a problem in this country from people wanting to vote who can't vote. We have a problem getting the people who are eligible to show up and vote.
Well, as you say in your editorial, bipartisan election reform is badly needed, but don't hold your breath.
That's right, because there are people who feel, there are people in the legislature who feel this would hurt them. This might hurt the chances of the Republican Party. Not all Republicans feel that way. Let me say that. And there's some evidence that it really doesn't change things that much. But really, I think that it's not a partisan thing, and we owe it to people. And Governor Snyder said this to make it as easy as possible for them to do their civic duty of voting.
Michigan Radio's political commentator, Jack Lessenberry. Always a pleasure. Thank you, Jack.
Pleasure to talk with you.
It can happen in a field near an abandoned building in Detroit or a now-defunct library in a small rural town in Michigan. The locations may differ, but the mission is the same. Medical students reaching out to provide health care to the uninsured. The student-run free medical clinic is an outreach effort offered by most medical schools. Usually, it's staffed by first and second-year med students responsible for virtually every aspect of the clinic. An MD would be on hand to write prescriptions and confirm diagnoses, but it really is the med students giving most of the care. What are the pros and cons of these free student-run clinics? That's the question posed by my next guest, who's a medical student at the University of Michigan. She recently wrote a piece for The Atlantic entitled Letting Medical Students Run the Clinic. Jennifer Hsu, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what made you want to write this story about letting medical students run the clinic?
Well, last year when I started interviewing at medical schools, a lot of students had come up to me and kind of touted their student-run free clinic as the highlight of their medical education. And they talk about what a great educational experience it was and how they were really exposed to health disparities. But one thing that was never really breached was kind of the quality of care that the patients were receiving. Was the care that they were receiving subpar? Was it worse than if they had gone to some other kind of place? And it really wasn't a conversation that was there. It was one that I kind of wanted to bring out in the article.
So did you go on, did you go along with students on the clinics to observe?
Yeah, I did. I spent an afternoon at the student-run free clinic in Pinckney, Michigan that the University of Michigan runs, and sort of saw how their workflow was working. They would have a first-year medical student usually kind of present to the patient, then they present that physical exam to an older medical student, and then they would go back to a doctor, an attending doctor in the back room, and kind of present to them and then go back to the patient again. So I felt that, not that the students were, you know, misdiagnosing the patient or that, you know, medications were being wrongly prescribed, but, you know, there were certain downsides to the student-run free medical clinic in that the care they were receiving was a little bit slower. This was the first time that students were really, you know, giving a physical exam in their lives. And I don't necessarily think that the patients, they were really thankful that they were receiving this care. But at the same time, I think from an educational standpoint, it can kind of perpetuate the stereotype that, you know, here are these groups of individuals who don't have any health insurance. Maybe we should be able to practice on them. And it just really wasn't a conversation that had been brought up.
Did you get the feeling they're being used as guinea pigs?
I didn't really feel like that. Okay. But it might have just been that because the conversation wasn't being had, that potentially this could be a problem, that we weren't sure whether the medical students knew for sure whether, you know, these patients were getting like slower care or less efficient care, just because the conversation wasn't put out there. They were just kind of thinking about the student-run free clinic as this like unmitigated good almost.
Well, it is easy to see, it feels like win-win, because you have students who get to actually get away from their laptops, get away from the anatomy lab, get away from books, and actually begin interacting and learn to interact with people. And probably the sooner the better as far as developing your skills as a physician. And you have people who may not otherwise get any medical attention.
Right. The thing is that there are other alternatives that these people without insurance could potentially turn to. And so the worry is that maybe because these student-run free clinics are there, they might be going to those areas instead of places that are staffed by kind of MD-caring doctors.
All right.
And I think maybe a bigger issue instead of the care, I mean, I don't know, I wouldn't say that the care that they're receiving is like below standard or subpar. I would just say that if students are only looking toward student-run free clinics as an educational experience and not as a place to discuss health disparities and the fact that poor people are maybe not getting the best care they possibly can and not having that space for them to talk about it, then that could be a potential downside of student-run free clinics.
So as you raise questions such as the ones you raise in your piece in The Atlantic, letting medical students run the clinic, did you raise these questions with students, and what kind of response did you get?
I did a little bit, and I think that the people who are running the clinic, so we have medical students who are in charge of ordering supplies and managing workflow, they were very aware of this issue. They were talking about how they were worried that, you know, because basically the way that the operation of the student-run free clinic works is that first-year medical students only probably can volunteer there once a year. And so their only experience in volunteering at this clinic is this one time for a concentrated 3 or 4 hour period of time. So in order to get all these sort of educational opportunities, there has to be this a little bit more
Not just a one-off.
Right. So that's kind of the sacrifice in between. It's like maybe the people who are really involved in the clinic are getting all of these experience about health disparities. But the ones who are just volunteering one time, maybe the only educational experience that they're getting is just learning how to do a physical diagnosis or learning how to talk to a patient, but not so much the health disparities.
You know, when I think about a visit, let's say that a student sees a lady, examines a lady, determines that she has hypertension and borderline diabetes. Well, then what? Does a supervising MD double check and maybe go re-examine if need be?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, the student, the doctor does. The patient is seen two times. So the first time they're seen alone with the medical student. The second time it's with the medical student and the doctor.
Okay. But then what about follow-up care and what about help with medications?
Yeah, they have a $5 they usually try to prescribe medications that are on the $5 pharmacy list. And then they also, they have this like specialty follow-up or referral service that they have. So in case that a patient would need it, they would redirect them to a service that had sort of cheaper care.
And is there are there other kinds of services in the sense of maybe helping these folks find other sources of medical care or deciding if they could, helping them sign up for Medicaid if they're eligible? Does that, is that part of what's offered?
Yeah, they're definitely working on it. They have sort of social worker students also affiliated with the clinic. I think the thing with that, though, is that in the process of them kind of navigating the system, they don't, like, you know, as a medical student, I don't know very much about what's going on. So in the process of them learning how to use the system, then the care that they're physically giving or the resources they have are not, you know, as great, as comprehensive as if, you know, if I were a doctor and I'd been working with these issues for the past 30 years. And so that's sort of where the tension comes between education and care.
Are you saying that you don't think these clinics should happen, or what
No.
are you saying?
I'm not saying that. I think that the biggest thing that I'm saying is that I think that we should talk about how there is this tension that exists between education and care. And usually in medical school, it's not just something that's really talked about. It's just kind of glossed over. It's like, oh, this is a win-win situation. We're getting education and we're providing care. But there is a little bit of a trade-off. It might not be a trade-off that's a bad thing, but it is a trade-off I think that we should be talking about.
And how would you solve – what would you think would be the way to solve that tension between education and patient care and needs?
One of the physicians that I talked to was saying that he thinks that there should be a dedicated reflection after every clinic session. So after the students are done taking care of the patients, there should be, you know, some kind of moderated discussion about what did we see today, what health disparities were we aware of right now, just some kind of space for the students to kind of decompress and really reflect on the day that they had just been volunteering at.
And plant seeds that I'm sensing the hope is that'll be borne out once that student's in practice.
Definitely, yes, because the general goal of student-run food clinics is also to have students to want to do these kinds of things when they have MDs and deal with health disparities. To that point.
Are you going to go out? I know you're first-year students, so you are, you know, very, very snowed under with a lot of schoolwork, but do you plan to go out on the free clinics?
Yeah, I definitely do. I think that the Michigan Free Clinic, from the care that I was seeing, I think it's a great service, and it's a, you know, really great way to learn about health disparities hands-on.
Jennifer Hsu, first-year medical student at the University of Michigan. She recently put a piece into The Atlantic entitled Letting Medical Students Run the Clinic. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
The Winter 2014 Olympics began today in Sochi, Russia. America's athletes will once again be sporting designs by Ralph Lauren. What you might not know is the sweaters and caps they'll wear for the closing ceremonies will be made from yarn produced in Michigan. Demi McDermott is a shepherd, a spinner, and a fiber artist. She owns Stonehedge Fiber Mill in East Jordan. So, Debbie, a woman strolled into your shop one day and asked for a few samples. What happened?
She bought a skein of yarn. She saw the sign on the highway and just stopped at the yarn shop and picked a skein of yarn. And as I was checking her out, she made the statement that she worked for a designer in New York City and she was going to take it back to the office. She thought it would be nice to use it in something. And I said, great, and then really didn't think anything else of it till 3 months later or so. Someone called and asked for samples and a color card, and when they were giving me the address to send it to, it was Polo Ralph Lauren, New York City, in which my jaw just kind of dropped open.
I bet.
Was very surprised.
And then you find out that you are going to help dress America's Olympians with your yarn.
Right, and that we didn't find that out until a few months after they made the purchase order. Thought possibly because it was a lot of red, white, and blue, but then they finally let it slip that, yes, that's what we were doing it for, and it was exciting.
Very good. How big an order was this? I'm assuming Ralph wasn't on the phone placing the order, but was it a big order for you?
It was. The purchase order was for just over 3,000 pounds of yarn, but all in all, it was probably closer to 4,000 by the time we got everything done, which is a lot of yarn.
Which is a nice boost for a small Michigan company.
Oh, definitely. Yes.
Well, really, your yarn is going to be on view to millions of people in the final sweaters. And these are the reindeer Nordic turtlenecks. These aren't the, should say, it's not the cardigans that a lot of people have commented on, perhaps not positively, but these are the reindeer Nordic turtleneck that they'll be wearing at the closing ceremony. Yeah. What do you think about the sweater that your yarn is in?
Oh, it's beautiful. We We got three of them. We purchased three of them, gave one to Governor Snyder just before Christmas in appreciation for his help with the agricultural community in Michigan. My daughter has one, and we have one.
Are you going to be watching that closing ceremony?
Oh, yes. We'll probably watch quite a bit of it.
Very good. Well, we thank you for talking with us. Now, as we see those sweaters at the closing ceremony, we're going to be thinking of Stonehenge Fiber Mill in East Jordan. Debbie, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When President Obama visits Michigan tomorrow, he'll be in East Lansing to sign into law the new massive farm bill. After years of debate, both the House and Senate finally passed the almost $1 trillion measure. And as usual in Congress, the legislation saw a split between Michigan's delegation, but not just the same old Republican versus Democratic split. Out of Michigan's five Democratic U.S. representatives, two voted against the bill, three in favor of it. One of those Democrats who voted for the bill joins us now, Congressman Dan Kildee of Flint. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Well, this bill finally cleared Congress, but there was opposition to it among both Democrats and Republicans, especially centering on the SNAP program, also known as food stamps. And
right.
Of course, as we know, Republicans in the House had wanted $40 billion in cuts to the program. Democrats pushed back, and the compromise is an $8 billion cut spread out over the years. But some of your Democratic colleagues couldn't stomach that much, but you voted in favor. Why was that?
Well, because, you know, I feel like I was sent to Washington to try to find solutions to the big problems that we face. And I agree with those critics of the SNAP cuts. They're more than I think what we should have had to include in this bill. But, you know, looking at the reality of what we would have if this farm bill did not pass, we would have no SNAP program whatsoever. And I was convinced that the votes simply would not be there in the House to pass anything but a compromise.
What do you think these SNAP cuts are going to look and feel like to your constituents, to people who have really come to rely on those benefits?
Well, hopefully they'll be minimal. I think one of the things that we've been able to do is to try to improve the SNAP program so that even though there could be marginal cuts for some participants, particularly those, and really only those that receive SNAP benefits through the LIHEAP authorization. It's a technical question, but the way the SNAP cuts were implemented was by increasing the amount of money that an individual needs to receive in heating assistance in order to automatically qualify for SNAP benefits. So hopefully it won't have a significant effect, but we did try to improve the bill in other ways. For example, the bill includes a provision that I offered to increase up to $100 million over the next 5 years, the amount of money to help people who are on SNAP to buy more healthy foods by doubling the purchasing power of their SNAP dollars when they buy locally grown fresh fruit and vegetables. So in some ways, obviously, it's something that could be argued either way, but the overall farm bill is better, and the SNAP program, unfortunately, like a lot of federal programs, saw a reduction. We will live to fight another day to try to get those dollars back.
Broadly speaking, Congressman, the Farm Bill, as we all know, covers so much more than just food stamps. We're talking crop insurance, research dollars. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on what this bill means for Michigan's farmers and Michigan consumers.
Well, it should be a big improvement. You're right. I mean, the Farm Bill includes the nutrition title, but it also includes conservation. And we significantly increased the commitment to land conservation in the Farm Bill, and it includes the commodity title, which is the title that deals with support for growers, for those farmers who are out there growing the crops that we depend upon. This bill takes us away from a long-standing practice of direct payments for farmers to support them as they go through the, you know, good years and bad years, away from that to a crop insurance model, where the only way they get paid for losses is if they truly experience those losses. So that was a big step forward. The
yeah.
other piece of it, which was really important to my district, is the continued support for Michigan's sugar industry. We are a big sugar beet producing state, and the Farm Bill includes provisions that protect Michigan sugar growers from foreign sugar companies that are subsidized by their governments from simply dumping sugar into our market and essentially pushing those growers out of the marketplace. We were able to preserve the protections for Michigan sugar growers. And for my district and lots of other places in Michigan, that was a really big victory.
Dan Kildee, Democratic Congressman from Flint, is always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It has now been 50 years since President Lyndon Johnson declared his war on poverty. There's a popular perception that President Johnson's war failed. Critics point to the official poverty rate and say it scarcely budged from 1964 to 2014, despite the $15 trillion the nation spent in those 50 years. But a University of Michigan economist challenges that view. She's co-author of a new paper that analyzes spending during the Johnson administration, and she believes it's wrong to call the war on poverty a failure. Martha Bailey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Why do you believe it's a mistake to call that war on poverty a failure?
So the first thing is, when the people think about the war on poverty, how they feel about it really depends on what they think it was. So a lot of people, when you say the war on poverty, they think about welfare or entitlements. But when Johnson declared the war on poverty, his agenda was really broad. It included things like preschool programs, one you might think of immediately as Head Start. Mm-hmm. But it also included things like increased funding for elementary and secondary education, tuition subsidies for needy college students, job training and retraining programs. It also included things like community health centers, Medicare, Medicaid, the expansion of the food stamps program, and one of the least well-known programs, I think, of the war on poverty is the Civil Rights Act.
He actually ran that through, and as you pointed out, LBJ really made that Civil Rights Act a pocketbook issue, didn't he? He really encouraged desegregation, and he wasn't afraid to fight for it.
That's right. You know, a lot of our memory of that era is sort of legal in nature. We see these civil rights marches. We see a lot of, you know, the National Guard standing in front of universities or public schools. And that's part of the story. But the other part of the story is that the Johnson administration refused to fund agencies and organizations with federal dollars that refused to comply. And what this means is that a lot of public schools couldn't get the increased funding that Johnson made available under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act unless they took steps towards desegregation. Hospitals couldn't receive reimbursements through Medicare and Medicaid unless they took steps towards desegregating their wards. So this ends up being a really important economic incentive for organizations across the country to start steps towards desegregation. And so the good news there is that poverty rates among African Americans fell really rapidly after 1965, and that the gap is about half what it was in 1964 today. Now, the bad news is poverty rates are still high for African Americans,
yeah,
and they're much higher than they are for other groups, but there has been tremendous progress there.
I'm speaking with University of Michigan economist Martha Bailey, whose writings focus on LBJ and the war on poverty. And it seemed largely as a failure, but she makes some very good points that it is not a failure. And if you look at the nuances of this war on poverty, there were many successes. And as you point out in your paper, the Johnson administration and LBJ were focused on fighting poverty, not on politics.
Well, this is a really interesting thing. So we typically think about how do presidents get credit for things? How do we blame politicians? When do we give them credit for different successes? Now, starting in the late 1960s, people had already written off the war on poverty. It was a failure. That was something that was being said by critics on both the right and the left. On the left, the criticism was that these programs hadn't gone far enough, and on the right, it was that these programs cost a lot. This was federal overreach. And no one really thought they were doing much. Now, the interesting thing about this is that poverty rates actually dropped substantially during the Johnson administration. And I don't mean to say that Johnson caused this drop in poverty rates. They were actually declining before he took office as well.
All right.
But poverty rates fall by about 30% during his administration. And at the same time, people are claiming that this war on poverty was a tremendous failure. So one of the questions then is, why does this view about the war on poverty come to be? What really drove that?
Yes.
And the answer we come up with in the paper is that the Johnson administration is fighting poverty. He's putting the dollars where poverty is the highest and when there are more people who are non-white, because we know that African Americans had substantially higher poverty rates in this era. He's not sending the money through political channels.
I'm wondering your thoughts, Martha, on this war analogy. Is poverty something that we can beat?
Well, that's interesting. You know, there are lots of things not to like about that analogy. The idea is that we can end poverty for once and forever. An interesting thing is that if you actually look to see the relationship between GDP and poverty rates, and the way that rising GDP had lifted all boats between World War II and about the mid-1960s, or I should say 1970, we would have eliminated poverty had this relationship stayed the same by about the mid-1980s. It would have been around, it would have been about zero in the United States. Now, something really interesting happens in the 1970s. The economy really starts to change. There's globalization, labor-saving technological change, reductions in union membership, all of these things. It's unclear exactly what drove this change, but somehow the growth in GDP stopped benefiting the least skilled workers. So what that means is that we get to the present, and really poverty rates haven't changed that much since the mid-1970s. And that's been sort of an explanation for why the war on poverty failed. But there's new evidence right now that looks to see how other measures of poverty, not just income measures of poverty, but measures of poverty that take account of a lot of the non-cash transfers, like food stamps and housing subsidies, other types of benefits that the federal government gives to reduce economic disadvantage, how those things have sort of improved the well-being of a lot of the poorest, America's poorest citizens. And according to those measures, in fact, those transfer programs have reduced poverty a great deal.
You know, interesting. You wrote an editorial in the HuffPost, Relearning the Lessons of the War on Poverty. And reading the comments after your piece, I have to get your thoughts on this. When you get a sense that there are people who view this war on poverty and subsequent efforts in the 1970s and since as redistribution, money was given, not a lot was demanded in return. How do you respond to those who believe that safety net programs have led to overdependency on a helping hand from the government?
Well, I think there are two responses. The first is that the war on poverty is much broader than the safety net programs, and that's really important. There were lots of human capital programs, health programs, things that we think help make the poor more able to participate as full economic citizens of this country. So you can think about a lot of these programs having very large productivity effects. So we think all of those things are good, not just in the short term, and a lot of those benefits aren't things that get picked up immediately in poverty rates. But the other type of thing, I think, that is a popular misconception is that safety net programs aren't just about handing out money. One of the things that Johnson pushes during his administration is that he wants to give people a hand up, not a handout. These programs were about increasing economic opportunity.
Martha, I'm wondering, do you see President Obama's focus on inequality as an extension of LBJ's war on poverty?
Well, that's interesting. I think there are lots of relationships there, and I think now one of the things we've been focused on is sort of poverty's become one of those words of the past. People don't want to talk about poverty as much, in large part because of a lot of the political backlash. Like I was telling you before, people began both on the right and the left to see the war on poverty as a failure, and that's been a reason for people to work aggressively to scale back its programs. Now, one of the things that I see happening now is there's a lot more focus on inequality on both sides of the aisle, and I think that may sort of a change in what we're calling this may enable more people to embrace this issue as one that's important.
Martha Bailey, University of Michigan economist. She and Nicholas Duquette are the co-authors of a paper entitled How Johnson Fought the War on Poverty, the Economics and Politics of Funding at the Office of Economic Opportunity. It's been a pleasure to talk with you, Martha. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
Living in poverty often means struggling to get enough to eat. But my next guest is trying to change that one meal at a time. Jonathan Kumar is using the power of social media to do good. In this case, you ordering a dessert or an appetizer at a restaurant, and in doing so, helping to feed a hungry child. Jonathan's mobile and web app, Food Circles, is currently up and running in Grand Rapids. Jonathan, explain to us, just how does Food Circles work?
So the app is free. It's for your iPhone or your Android smartphone. It's also available on our website, joinfoodcircles.org, if you don't have a smartphone. The app and site lets you buy a dish at a local restaurant for just a dollar, so it's a discounted price, and 100% of the price you pay for that dish goes straight to feed a hungry child through your organization of choice. After you make a purchase, you'll get a voucher on your phone or an email you can print out, and you just need to show that to the staff at the restaurant. they'll bring out that special dish that you donated for, and then hopefully you're going to order beer and a burger alongside that too.
Now, where did you get this idea? This is a really creative way to, you know, be out and on the spur of the moment say, I want to help. But where'd the idea come from?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. We ask a lot of people around us, hey, do you do enough to impact others in your life? And a lot of the times the answer is no. And a lot of the common reasons behind that is not out of a lack of desire, but out of a lack of time, maybe a lack of money. But one thing a lot of people do is eat out once a week, twice a week, five times a week.
Mm-hmm.
And just as a college student at the University of Michigan, I thought, you know, is there something more we can do with our everyday dining behavior that can, you know, solve needs for people who could never dream of going out to, you know, Zingerman's or Frito Petito's or something like that. So I thought, you know, is there a way to help restaurants and in the process, you know, help those who don't have that much food to put on the table for their families?
So what kind of response have you gotten? Especially start with how many restaurants have you been able to get on board?
Yeah, well, it's something where there's definitely a balance between how many people have our app and the site and how many restaurants are a part of things. And so 20 restaurants in Grand Rapids, all of them locally family owned, have decided to become what we call a buy one, feed one restaurant, where they're, you know, offering a dish, like an appetizer or dessert on the site. And we have about over 1,000 people have our app or have been to the site and have used it to, you know, get a dish and get a good deal on their end, but also, you know, make a difference in someone's life.
And when you look at what you've been able to set up for Grand Rapids, what are the options and what are the plans to have this app up and running in other cities in Michigan or even be able to use it outside of Michigan in other states or even other countries?
Yeah. I mean, our mission is to give city diners a chance to sustain a hungry child just by eating out. We have a really, really small team here in Grand Rapids, and that's honestly why I was really interested in speaking with you guys is just because we need more assistance. We need to connect to people in other areas, Lansing, Kalamazoo, back in Ann Arbor, Detroit, obviously, and connect to people who are interested in starting, setting up food circles in their community so their diners can start to, you know, do something powerful with their appetite, with their hunger.
Jonathan Kumar, developer of a mobile and web app called Food Circles. You can find out more by going to the website, joinfoodcircles.org. Thanks so much for talking with us, Jonathan, and good luck with the effort.
Thank you so much for having us.
Stateside was directed today by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer was Bob Skahn. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Haddle, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Werniak. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock.